Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It was 4 years ago today in Ferguson, Missouri, when a white police officer, you maybe remember the name, Darren Wilson, shot and killed Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager. The shooting and subsequent protests helped to fuel the Black Lives Matter movement. Later that same year, 2014, the murders of two NYPD officers led to the foundation of the counter-movement Blue Lives Matter. The public has remained sharply divided since 2014, and obviously these are not issues that are even just that recent, but less than a third of African Americans say they have confidence in the police, while the majority of white Americans have a negative opinion of BLM. But where does that leave the 13% of law enforcement officers who are African American? For over 28 years, my next guest, Matthew Horace, was one of those officers. He is now a law enforcement and security expert for CNN, an adjunct professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and the author of a new book reflecting on his experiences as an African-American police officer entitled The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. He joins us now. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us about yourself? First, where did you grow up, and why did you go into law enforcement?
Well, great, thanks. Well, I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, during the 70s and the 80s, and I had a somewhat exposure to Philadelphia police growing up, and I knew the culture that existed in that city and others. I went to college in Delaware, Delaware State University, and I think, as you may know, during my sophomore year, I was home for a parade for the Philadelphia 76ers, and unfortunately, I was attacked by a Philadelphia police canine officer. Of course, I wasn't arrested because I wasn't charged or anything like that, but it was my first foray into the world of the blue line, so to speak, and when we went to get reports about the incidents and about what had happened, we learned on the police report that the police reported that they didn't know what type of injury I had or what the origin of the injury was. And, you know, of course, I had given them a full account of what had occurred and what happened and what the officer looked like and the dog and everything else. So that was sort of like my first experience with police. And
that's a serious experience.
Sure, sure. And it didn't sour me, though, because when I was coming out of college, policing seemed interesting to me because I always felt like if you want to be a part of the solution rather than the problem, you have to take steps in that direction. So I started applying to police departments nationally.
And I want to apologize for not giving you the right credits as I was introducing you, security expert for CNN and The Wall Street Journal, and author of the new book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. What are some of the law enforcement jobs you've had? Because you've worked in various kinds, right?
Sure, sure. Well, I was a local police officer in Arlington, Virginia, which is suburban Washington. I was an ATF special agent and eventually, you know, rose through the ranks to become an ATF senior executive. I served in various capacities to include our special response team, our national response team. I was a peer support counselor for agents involved in critical incidents, and I was in executive leadership roles both in Denver and in Newark, New Jersey. So,
what'd you do in Newark?
I was a special agent in charge for ATF in Newark, New Jersey.
Ah, for the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yes, sir.
And that was during the height of the crack epidemic and what we generally call the war on drugs, which ravaged black communities, both from the drug side and the law enforcement side. Was your approach to policing drug crimes at the time any different from your white colleagues as you look back on it?
No, as I look back on it, I think we all felt like we were there for a noble purpose. And during the war on drug-centric, I was in Baltimore, I was in New England and Boston and other cities, and we felt like what we were doing was making a difference because anytime you take guns and drugs and thugs off the street, you feel like it's a good day. And whether it was an undercover operation, buying guns from gang members, whether it was a search warrant, seizing kilos of cocaine and guns and money, you really felt like it was making a difference in the communities.
And we're now in another drug epidemic, this time with opioids. And I think it's fair to say that the language around drug enforcement sounds very different than during that war on drugs era. It seems to me that there's a lot more compassion, a lot more focus on treatment, a lot more focus on people being victims of the drugs rather than people who use the drugs being perpetrators, and maybe that has to do with race.
Sure. Well, I think the overwhelming majority of us feel that race and socioeconomics play a factor in the fact that during my time and being out here in the war on drugs, it was a law enforcement crisis. And now things have shifted, and now it's a public health crisis. Well, it's always been a public health crisis, if you really think about it, because it all boiled down to people. But we approached our enforcement tactics very differently back in the 80s and 90s and even 2000s.
Listeners, who has a question or a thought for Matthew Horace, now author of The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement? You can share an experience. You can share a thought. You can ask him a question about his experiences and thoughts. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You say in your book that a lot of the issues with race and law enforcement begin at the police academy. What happens? What goes wrong?
Well, I think there are two factors, what goes right and what goes wrong. So what goes right is you're there to get training. You're there to learn law and about policing and the way to do proper policing, policy, strategy, and regulation. What goes wrong is when you leave the academy and people are trained, and it happened to me and it's happened to almost everyone I know, and people tell you the first thing they say is, forget everything you learned at the academy because this is the way it's done in the street. And to that strategy's credit, every place is uniquely different. New York is different from Detroit. Detroit's different from Newark. The problems are different in different cities. And certainly, the people who are teaching you how to do the job have a large impact on how you develop as a young police officer. But this is where it starts, because people are out here day in and day out, and they're dealing with people in the worst conditions and the worst days of their lives, and people just start to get hardened.
How does, in your experience and now in your research, because it's been a long time since you've been in the police academy, how do they try to weed out racist or potentially violent police cadets, or just train against the implicit bias that officers may not realize they have when they're out on the street?
So there are two factors. There's the hiring process, right, which is meant to weed out certain behaviors, to include, in a lot of cases, background investigations, polygraph examinations, full-scope oral panel interviews where 8 or 9 people weigh in to the applicant's process, and include psychological examinations. And then when you get into the field and you're training under a field training officer, there's daily documentation as to your habits, your writing, your speech, your language, how you carry yourself. And those sorts of things are supposed to weed out the behaviors. But then there's the departmental things like implicit bias or unconscious bias training. And, you know, I've been around a lot of departments, a lot of agencies, and through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, I can't think of too many agencies that haven't offered that training to their officers and agents along the way. The problem is it has to be practiced, it has to be understood, and you have to understand where your biases are and how to deal with them.
In your book, you cite the New Orleans Police Department as a case study in reform. How so?
Well, New Orleans has completely turned the ship, if there was a ship to be turned. They've had several different police superintendents down there that have been steadily and organically trying to change that culture from one of corruption and even criminal behavior to one of professionalism and accountability. The current superintendent, Michael Harrison, has done an exceptional job of weeding out officers who didn't want to be there. You know, if you recall, New Orleans had officers that were arrested for murder, for running drugs during Hurricane Katrina. Officers committed murders, and this goes beyond being a bad cop. This goes beyond being a criminal.
How would you rank or rate New York's police department on these scores?
Well, I mean, New York has a very unique situation, the largest police department in the United States, the largest city in the United States, the most boroughs, the largest transit. They have the largest, the biggest of almost everything imaginable. So it becomes very difficult to quantify what success looks like. And there's been a lot of initiatives. There's been broken windows. There's community policing. But it's very hard to quantify. And success from a law enforcement standpoint tends to look at things like crime. So if crime goes down, we're successful. But the question always has to be asked, at what cost? So if crime goes down but engagement is down, it really isn't successful. What you would like to have is engagement be up between the community and police and policing community. It's not all one way. It's both ways.
And do you have an assessment of New York along that scale, or haven't you looked closely enough at our particular police department?
No, I can't say. I mean, I lived here in New York for a number of years, and a lot of my friends work for the police department and work here in the feds. It's hard to make that assessment.
LaTanya in Rockland County, you're on WNYC with Matthew Horace. Hi, LaTanya. LaTanya, are you there?
I am. I'm sorry. I was listening on mute.
That's
good
okay.
Morning.
Hi
How
there.
Are you, Brian?
Good. Thanks for calling.
So my question for your guest is, and welcome to the show, and thank you for the information that you're providing, and thank you for the information that you're sharing, the insider information. My question is, were there any steps that were taken by officers of color while you were in uniform or while you were on active duty to address the racism in that system of law enforcement?
Well, I think what generally happens is, so there's two ways to answer that question. What generally happens, and the way I've seen it done most often, is that officers deal with it one-on-one with other officers. If they hear a racial slur or something that's inappropriate, they'll address it with officers one-on-one. The other thing they can do is report it to their supervisors within the departments. And in more cases than not, you see officers try to handle it person to person before they take it up the chain. And then if it's really egregious and it goes up the chain, it becomes a disciplinary matter. And many times people are suspended or giving disciplines for use of racial slurs or things that relate to unconscious or implicit bias.
Any follow-up, LaTanya? Yep, she's gone. I guess she got her answer. Justin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Justin.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have two questions for your guest. When I was coming here, there was to this country, I'm from Jamaica, there was a retired police officer who he was discussing about the police issue here. He was a traffic cop for some years. And he told me that if he stopped a white person for a violation and he let that person go free, he said he go home feel like he do something good. He said if he do the same thing with a black person, he said he go home feel like he didn't do his job. And he said that's the way the system taught you. I don't know if he's lying or he's telling the truth. Now, on the other hand, I see something take place with Mayor de Blasio when the police officers turned his back, their back mm-hmm. on him.
Right.
And remember, that was about a racial gesture.
That was about him saying that he's had the conversation with his son, Dante, who's black, half black, about being prepared to deal, and I don't want to put words in his mouth because I don't remember the exact quote, but as a black kid, basically he had to be ready to be in certain situations with police officers, right?
Right.
And they turned their back on him as if that was not a thing.
Not the black police officer turned their back on him. So is it a system that radicalized the mind to behave a certain way or to behave just one way towards one race?
Justin, thank you very much. Do you think it's that bad?
Well, I think certainly we are in a system, known as the thin blue line, and we are taught and culturalized to protect each other at all costs, and unfortunately sometimes. And there's a belief that we're the only ones who understand what it is we do. And that sort of bands people together sometimes, often in ways which are counterproductive to the bigger mission. So I would say it's probably as intense as it seems, but it may not be as bad as it seems. At the end of the day, it's up to each individual to do the right thing when they're called on to do the right thing.
Do you, what's your own feeling as somebody who's on, both sides of this? You're black and you're a law enforcement officer. What's your own feeling about Black Lives Matter as a movement?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've always felt from the very beginning that they started the discussion. I felt that they could have done it in a different way in many cases, but I thought that to address a problem, you have to change the discussion to change the narrative. So I think the discussion started as a result of Black Lives Matter and has moved to where we are today. But I've never seen it as being totally anti-police, right? Of course, that was sort of the rhetoric that was put out there. But that happens because in our culture, we see everyone who's not with us as against us. And oftentimes that's detrimental and it creates detrimental outcomes.
So how about Blue Lives Matter as a response to that?
Well, I've always felt that ever since I've been in the profession, I've always felt like my life mattered. I've been treated uniquely and specially for my entire career. And I never felt the need to come back with the Blue Lives Matter mantra because I've never felt like my life didn't matter as a person in blue.
Zoe in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Zoe.
Hi. You know, I I've been interested to hear about de-escalation training for police officers, which sounds like it's done kind of spottily over the country. And I'd like to hear what your guest has feels as a recommendation for that, both for New York and other police.
I think that's a great question. And people who pay attention to this issue know that in many of these incidents where somebody winds up shot, there's a question about whether the officers involved engaged in de-escalation techniques that they're supposed to get trained in at the police academy and maybe ongoing, so that there's the maximum chance of calming down an incident rather than ratcheting it up to a point where they may feel that firing their weapon is necessary. And I wonder what you think about the question.
Well, de-escalation training is a good thing, and it does work in departments who use it. But as you stated earlier, it's sort of given spottily around the country. There's no mandate that says every police department in America must exercise de-escalation training. However, there are departments, and in the black and the blue, there are a number of police executives and chiefs who have said that de-escalation training works. The challenge is, and we point this out in the book, the job of a police officer or a law enforcement person is very, very difficult. And each individual incident is very uniquely different. So when the person is on the scene and these things are happening very fluidly and very quickly, oftentimes the thought doesn't come to de-escalate. The thought comes to end the problem, stop the threat, move on to the next call, get done with this, get back to the station and get back out on the street. De-escalation has to become a part of the psyche for it to really work. It has to be automatic. And you have to think de-escalate rather than escalate. And I don't know that that's been done, wholesale as a country yet.
Do you think things are getting better in terms of, let's say, police dealing with black Americans?
No, I think that there are two sides of that point. I think the division is getting worse. I think the perception of police by minority and disenfranchised communities is getting worse. And the tension from police to the communities is getting worse. And the tension is getting worse on both sides. So we don't see it getting better. And each and every time people see something else on television, on a video, it gets worse and worse.
And so that's the perception. Do you have any thoughts about how the world moves toward more common ground on this?
Yeah, and we were hoping to address that in the book in many ways. Number one, there needs to be more understanding from the public of what the job entails to be a police person or law enforcement. Number two, people have to look to policies and regulations and sort of start asking, why are police involved with certain things? And I'll give you an example. When you look at the numbers of people who are shot and killed by police who are mentally ill, the question should be asked, why are police being dispatched to calls where they're ill-equipped or not trained to handle the problems? But we don't do that. When there's a mentally ill person that's creating a concern, the first thing we do is call police. Well, the answer is to have crisis managers, right? But every police department in the country doesn't have crisis managers available to send out with police officers. The other issue, when you look at the statistics of traffic stops and who's stopped and who gets in confrontation and who's arrested, look at what happened in Ferguson with the taxing and the fining, hundreds of thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of people with hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines and warrants and things like that. So it becomes a policy issue at one level, and then it becomes an execution issue at another level. But the fact of the matter is this, black police officers should also remember that police were used to enforce segregation. And that's how policing started in the United States. And many people still see it that way. So there needs to be better understanding on all sides of the fence.
And with respect to Ferguson, even though the one police officer was found not to have committed a crime in his shooting of Michael Brown, all that systemic racism was then later found in the department when
Sure.
the Justice Department looked at it. So in our last 20 seconds, what's most on your mind today on this fourth anniversary of the Ferguson shooting?
What's on my mind is trying to continually change that narrative, because the narrative still is there aren't racist police officers, and they are, because racism is a problem in society. Implicit bias and unconscious bias are still issues in terms of how people interact. We want to keep the dialogue going and help to change this narrative.
Matthew Horace's new book is The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. And by the way, he'll be presenting around his book tonight at the Brooklyn Historical Society. That's 128 Pierpont Street at 6:30 this evening. You can reserve a seat at brooklynhistory.org. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.